Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. Someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit my next bar.
When I was a little girl, in probably second or third grade, I didn't think I was supposed to be as good as the boys were at the math that we were learning. I don't think anybody really told me not to be good at it, but somehow I was just sure that I shouldn't be. I mentioned it to Mom. I even asked her about it. Luckily. Otherwise, I might have stuck with that very clear impression that it was just wrong to be as good as the boys at math. But Mom said, "That's silly. If you're good at it, be good at it." Well, I was young enough to just take her at face value, and I was good at math. I mean, I already had been good at it. Learning the multiplication tables in second grade, I not only memorized them quickly, but I understood what it meant to multiply something and how cool it was that the system all worked and made sense. I was one of the kids that worked one-on-one with the other kids in class who weren't getting it. And I kept on being good at math, and at other subjects too, until they were less interesting than boys and skipping class and, well, other things, but that's another story. By the time I went to college, I studied science. It was a discipline in the physics department, and now that's a department with mostly guys and mostly geeky guys, my favorite kind, by the way. But our department was nearly 50-50 women, though. It was called space science. And so I never really noticed in most of those classes that most of the students were men. Because it's true that they were mostly men. Physics classes drew students in all the engineering disciplines, in physics and chemistry and biology and astronomy, too. But they also came into those classes from my major, and we were 50-50. So we girls weren't on our own, and we weren't looked down on by our professors or our fellow students. However, by the time I was a junior, we had to take the dreaded electromagnetic fields class series, taught by the electrical engineering department. I walked into the class and immediately knew that I was in a foreign place. The class of 40 or so guys was indeed a sea of guys, electrical engineers. We were three women among them, all space science majors. The men didn't talk to us. They weren't used to taking classes with women, I suppose. And now they also had another reason to be suspicious of women. The teacher was the rare female teacher in electrical engineering. She was smart, and she was fast at her work, and she was young, and she worked for the icon of the school. She ended up at Los Alamos, Zahia Drisi, from Albania. She was a tough teacher of tough material. Now, that might be what got me by. It might have been that it was a math-intensive course and that math was so glorious that it really didn't matter much to me what the EM fields were supposed to be doing as far as I was concerned, but the guys hated her. I'll never forget the horrible sexist comments that I would overhear them making about her looks and her sexuality. My grades were great, though. They weren't perfect, but they were good. While they struggled, these guys, in their own major. I may not have found new friends in these classes, all three of these classes, by the way, but I learned a lot. Most of it was about my ability. But it's a strange and isolating feeling to be one of the few or the only in a room full of men, or at a table of all men, or in a position always filled by men. But it can be rewarding, too. because you never know how you might break new ground for yourself and for women who follow you. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, and today our show is called Man's World. We have four pieces from women who dare to enter places normally populated by men, places that we all find ourselves from time to time, sometimes by choice, sometimes by accident. These tales are coming up.
This is a man's world. This is a man's world. But it wouldn't be nothing without a woman or a girl.
Installment number one. Kathy Aiken is the Dean of the College of Letters, Arts, and Social Sciences at the University of Idaho, the first woman in this role, and one of the few women in the professional circles that she works in on campus. Yin Radio's Anna Maria Roque talked to Kathy about being a woman in this man's world.
All my students have heard me say this a number of times. History is my discipline. And if you walk up the stairs on the third floor of this building, you will see the professors emeritus of history's photographs mm-hmm. there. And I now have enough time that I would be, even if I left tomorrow, I'll be the first woman there. And there have been historians since we started the university in 1889. So that says something about the nature of the climate for women. And when I look, even in this college now, at the full professors, I think there are only five or six women full professors in this whole college at this moment. And there's not a single woman chair in my own college. And so things have changed, but there is a woman dean, which there never was before. So
you're the first woman dean?
First woman dean. First tenured woman in history, first woman chair in history, first woman dean in this college. And you would think, I mean, it is 2008,
yeah.
that wouldn't be the case.
Yeah.
It seems like to me. So we still have some issues. And whenever we survey women and ask about climate, it's clear that we have some climate issues for women at the University of Idaho, even at this point. We don't really have women in, like, in the key leadership positions, like presidents or vice presidents. I think women feel vulnerable at tenure and promotion time. I think they feel vulnerable in a number of staff and academic settings. I think they feel that... I think they feel that it's much more difficult to be a woman in either a faculty or staff position at the University of Idaho than it is to be a man. And I think they're right. Even now. I mean, I think when I teach, one of the things I used to teach was women's history, but when I teach, I think students think that issues involving gender are over and won. And I think when they get into the workplace, they find that that is not the case.
I
think if you think
it.
That that's true, you're fooling yourself. I think that's a really interesting phenomenon. I think women speak up, and I think, I mean, there are a lot more women. Like, the history department has two women now, and when I was there, three. So at least it's a lot different to be by yourself than to have some others.
Sure.
And so I think that has really changed. But I sit on the president's cabinet, and there are only a couple of women there in this whole big room of men. And even at the provost council, which is deans and some other folks, there aren't very many women there. Certainly we're a distinct minority there still. So, and you just can't help but notice that.
Kathy Aiken is the Dean of the College of Letters, Arts, and Social Sciences at the University of Idaho, Anna Maria Roque spoke with her last fall. Installment number two comes from some place completely different from academia, a place where people work with their hands, not at desks. Moscow mom Erin Jepson reads this entry from her blog.
Woman in a man's world. My car pulled away from the preschool building, the weak winter sun glinting off the windshield. My small son, now the sole occupant of the back seat, held a small pink heart-shaped eraser in his hand, a cherished treasure belonging to his sister, who had not been allowed to take it into her class. Seth had confiscated it, and now he held it gleefully in his chubby fist. Instead of going home, I mentally ran through the list of stores in town, wishing I had some kind of errand to run. We had just been to several stores during the weekend, all the places that furnish our home with basic supplies. Suddenly, I recalled that I had wanted to check some prices at one of the local hardware stores. For months now, I had wanted to get my kids a toddler table and chair set, which unfortunately cost several hundred dollars on sites like Amazon. I wondered if the building supply place would have the materials to make a table more cost-effectively. Ever since I worked there, I have loved going back. I love doing projects, building and creating things out of wood and paint. I enjoy talking to old coworkers, many of whom still work there. I pulled into the parking lot and extracted my cheerful baby from his car seat. Once inside, I stuffed him into a shopping cart and headed off to look at table legs. As I passed the counter, the man there looked from me to the baby and asked, "May I help you find what you're looking for?" with an expression that implied if I attempted to navigate the store by myself, I might end up completely lost in the caulking aisle and began shrieking for help. Rather than explain that not only did I used to work there, but I probably arranged the aisle in question and programmed the computer to print the bin tags for it, I merely thanked him and said, "No." 10 feet further, I was accosted by another employee, this one a woman, asking if she could help me. "No thanks," I answered. I pushed my baby-filled shopping cart toward the table legs once again and heard the inevitable, "May I help you, ma'am?" before I had gotten 20 more feet. Looking around at the males in the store, happily browsing in respected peace and tranquility, I gritted my teeth. "No thanks, I know where I'm going." I got to my aisle at last, looked at table legs, and actually decided to purchase the materials to make a table. Out in the lumber yard, I hunted down a yard guy and selected a scrap of particle board for the top. He quoted me the price of $1 for the piece. I thanked him and headed to the register to pay for my items. The woman there looked at me as if I had two heads when I described the scrap of lumber to her. "It's a closeout," I said. The guy in the back said I could have the scrap of particle board for $1. Unconvinced, she must needs radio to the back to make sure I had told the truth, asking the yard guys about my, quote, plywood, and ended up charging me $1.50. I thought wistfully of the days when I had worked there and the males who came through the line were assumed to know the difference between particle board and plywood. Eventually, I bought the stuff, which came to $30, picked up my scrap of wood, and headed home. I got out two screwdrivers, one for me and one for baby Seth, and we got to work. It took 45 minutes to screw the hardware to the particle board piece, attach the legs, and cover the top with contact paper, in spite of Seth's help. Soon, I had a sturdy, cute little table. My boy highly approved, testing it out by climbing on top of it. Soon, it was time to go to calculus class. I dropped the baby off with my husband, who is scheduled to pick Natalie up from preschool as well. I trudged up the hill and entered my classroom, where, out of the 45 students, maybe 6 were female. The teacher passed back our tests, and to my delight, I found my score quite acceptable. It was most likely better, in fact, than the 39 guys sitting all around me. Reflecting on my day, I found myself somewhat irritated by the fact that nearly every person I encountered today treated me as though I had the mental capacity of a goldfish, just because I was carrying a baby. The civil rights movement may have opened opportunities for women, but has done little, I think, to change the underlying assumptions that women are less ambitious or less intelligent than men. Chatting with a friend the other day about taking calculus, she casually mentioned that her mother had warned her, "Don't be smarter than the guys." I don't particularly want to fight a civil rights battle. I just want to be myself, and to build tables when the whim strikes. Unfortunately, I have a feeling that this won't be the last time I'll encounter this phenomenon of being a woman in a man's world. I guess the way to educate them will be to do my best and to show people that success doesn't depend on gender, but on skill and on work ethic.
That was Erin Jepsen. You can read her blog at whistlererin.livejournal.com. That's whistlererin.livejournal.com. The background music for the piece was by Philippe Mangold. Jessica Hokeson is a firefighter. She works on an engine. That's what they call the equipped pickup trucks that go out to the fire lines. And this is an engine that her dad runs. She works side by side with her older brothers, and she's been at it now for 4 years. There are more and more women firefighters, but they still are relatively rare. And she's the only one on her crew. Here's how it all works.
Well, it's not very glamorous. That would probably be the first thing. It's dirty, sweaty, nasty, hard work. It's the hardest work I've ever done in my life. Every day, it's like 12 to 16 hour days. And you have to wear all of your PPE all day long, every day. Your hard hat, your long sleeve, Nomex shirt and pants, socks and boots and gloves, and our fire shelters. And that's a pack that we have to wear. And it's just, I mean, different things every day. Digging fire line, running hose lays, pumping water.
But it's not just hard physical work, it's hard mental work, too.
Mainly just staying safe. That's your biggest concern is staying safe. And a lot of the mental thing is working well with everybody, you know, not because when bad things happen out there, it's power struggles. When people get hurt, when people die, it's usually a power struggle that causes it. That's somebody thinking that this is what you should be doing or this is what you should be doing, and just that collision gets things disorganized and people where they're not supposed to be, and bad things happen then. And a big thing of it is not getting cabin fever and getting, you know, you're out there with the same people for 14-day rolls at a time, and you just gotta keep yourself sane. that's the big thing, probably.
Do you have any techniques for keeping sane?
Yeah, I sketch a lot. I draw a lot while I'm out there. I always bring not necessarily while we're working during the day, but just to have some kind of release and creative mind, keep my mind actively creative. I do a lot of sketching.
Now, there's not a lot of time for sketching, what with an average of 14 hours a day on the line. The engines Jessica works on are mainly there to get water to the line for initial attacks. This is when there are new starts of fire, and you're the first ones out there to the fire line. Here's an example.
I think it was my second year on fires, so I was 19 years old, probably, and I was with my dad and my older brother, and we were in Hardin, Montana. And the fires over there are, I mean, it's really eastern Montana. And so the fires burn quick and hot, and then they're out because it's cattle lands and grass fields and things like that. And we had been on IA all day, just on call. We hadn't had any new starts or anything, so we had just been doing normal work all day. And dinner time rolls around, and we get called out. So we've done a full day of work, and we get called out on this lightning strike, this lightning start. And it takes 2 hours for them to figure out where this is and to get us out there and all these roundabout, windy back country roads to get to this fire. And by that time, it's dark. And fire is so much scarier and more intense looking in the dark. It is like, it's just this monster, this red breathing fire, scary, scary thing. And we pull up to this, and my brother has been doing this for probably 4 or 5 years at this time, and my dad's been doing it forever. And it's only my second year, and we pull up to this fire, and I was scared. I was really scared, and I tried not to let it show because you never want to show fear. And my brother, I remember, he didn't show a lot of emotion, and my brother grabbed my hand, and he said, "It's going to be okay," because I thought I was hiding it better, but apparently he could tell that I was scared. It could have been that he felt that uncertainty too, because it's not a familiar thing to be fighting fire at night in the dark. It's a scary thing just in itself, and with this being an initial attack, a brand new start, it was just blowing up. And it was in timber, and we just started trying to build a fire line around this. And at points in the night, we worked all through the night, and at points in the night, my boots would get so hot that I could feel my feet felt like they were burning, and because I would be digging and all this hot stuff, and my friend Jesse, who fights fires on a different engine with us, he would spray my boots off, because he would have the hose, he would spray my boots off, and I would keep digging, and I mean, by that time, it just boils right off of your boots, because your boots are too hot.
Like
mm-hmm. So my feet just hurt. Leather. They're the thick sole, heavy-duty work boots.
How did you feel when your brother took your hand and said that?
Well, I felt comforted that he was there and he was going to keep me safe, and I knew that, but I also was a little unnerved that he had been concerned enough to tell me, "Oh, it's going to be okay." You know, he was obviously on edge too, so that was scary. But yeah, we fought fire all night on this fire, and in the morning, I'll never forget this. In the morning, they got us up. They told us to bed down around 4 o'clock, I think, where there were no rattlesnakes. And I said, "Oh, the cab looks great. I'm going to sleep right here." So I fell asleep with my hard hat and my gloves still on, just sitting upright in the pickup. And they woke us up again in just a few hours and had us go back to work. We just slept right out there on the fire line. And we're out there working the next morning. This is the most tired any of us have ever been. My dad, my brother, and I, just mentally exhausted. Don't know how our bodies are still functioning because we've just worked the hardest day of our lives. And this guy comes, and we're doing this for a few hours, and we're like, "I can't believe that you know that they have us out here still doing this when our work to sleep ratio has been completely blown out of the water. They have just disregarded that." And I'm out there working, and this guy comes tearing up on his four-wheeler. It's the landowner. And we have just been working all night, you know, working our asses off to save this guy's land, and did a really, really amazing job. And he pulls up and he goes, "A woman firefighter? We didn't let women fight fires when I used to fight fire back in the day. This is bull. We don't let women fight fire." And I just stopped. I couldn't even say anything. I was so blown away by this guy's arrogance. I just stood there, and nobody else heard. I just wanted to take this guy out. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. I'll never forget that feeling of just complete.
How'd you deal with that?
I didn't.
You had your mind churning for hours.
Oh, yeah.
Days, weeks.
Oh, yeah. I was fuming, and I didn't have the, I don't know, I couldn't even speak. We were so, so tired. I didn't say anything back to him. I just stared at him in disbelief. I couldn't believe it. And my dad came up afterwards, and I was just livid, just pissed. And he's like, what is wrong? And I told him what happened, and he couldn't believe it, and he felt horrible. And I was just like, no, this is not right. And I mean, there was nothing we could do about it, but...
Yeah, makes you real tempted to let it burn,
though, doesn't it? Oh, yeah, I couldn't believe it. Yeah, you're welcome, buddy.
That would have been an okay response, too. Didn't you have responses
lined up? Oh, yeah. No, I would probably spray him with the hose. If I was just standing there with the hose, I should have just sprayed him right in the face, I think, and been like, you jerk. Yeah. Or...
That would have been a real good response.
I know. Yeah. I really
and
wish I would have.
Had to use anything like that since. Has anybody else said anything so... or close to as rude?
Well, I mean, it's always a struggle being respected. I have to work twice as hard as any guy that I work with to get any respect as a woman out there.
Jessica has learned a lot since then, including how not to take a lot of crap.
We were in California this summer, and we were on a fire. We had just gotten there that night, so I mean, we weren't dirty yet or anything, because we had just gotten into camp, driven all day to get to camp, and we were supposed to eat dinner and bed down, they told us. So we're in line. We have our Nomex on and everything, and we're in line to get dinner. And one of the camp crew people, the people that run the camp that we stay in, came up to me and said, are you here with a crew or an engine? What? And I was like, I'm on an engine. What engine are you on? Just grilling me with questions. And I was like, I'm on Troy Fire Service. We're on a contract engine. And he goes, you just look out of place. I said, excuse me? He goes, you just look out of place. You don't look the part. Are you sure you're... Like, he thought I was just there for a free meal or something. And I was like, yes, I'm here on the fire. What have you been doing all day? I was so pissed. Because he's not a firefighter. He's not out there fighting fire either. He just thought that I looked out of place. And I said, what have you been doing all day? I was...
How did he answer?
He just stood there. And then he... okay, and then walked away.
Good.
I of course went. My dad was the one that got the wrath of it. I went and sat down with him and told him what happened, and I was just pissed.
The work deserves respect and generally gets it from everyone. And I saw Jessica on break from firefighting a couple of summers ago when she went out to celebrate her 21st birthday. She didn't look like a firefighter. She was gorgeous, as she can be fighting fires, and as I generally know her to be, but she was also all curls and glow, and she was in a skirt and makeup, and trailed by an entourage of guys, her guy friends, fellow firefighters. What I saw was a bunch of young, wiry, strong men trailing a girly girl into the bar.
See, I don't feel girly.
No,
I feel very... Especially when I'm out on fires, I guess. I feel very frumpy and blah.
Yeah.
Like my first days back off of fires, I just want to be a girl again. I just want to feel like a girl again. And I get all dolled up, and we usually will go out. Because my brothers, definitely, because I fight fires with my two older brothers usually, and they will definitely, they want to celebrate being home, and so... I turn back into a girl, and I let my hair down, and
yeah.
It's fun.
Put on the makeup.
Mm-hmm. Because when we're... Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Because it's usually warm, and in the summer, if I'm not on fires, I am in a skirt.
Jessica is, like most of us, more than just single-dimensional. She is a girly girl, and she is a tough girl. She's a woman working in a man's world sometimes, and taking lessons from the experiences into the rest of her life.
Yeah, I think I've had a lot more confidence. Just because it makes me feel like I'm doing something good. I'm helping. I'm doing something good with my life. I'm a better person, maybe.
Think you're going to keep firefighting?
Yeah, I think I will keep firefighting as long as I am physically able. I really like it. I'd like to have a job or career in the off season that would allow me to fight fire in the summer. Because it's a really rewarding thing. And it all just comes with time. I mean, I've only been doing it for 4 years. Lots of people have been doing this a lot longer. And you learn something new every year. You learn so much more, and you see how things work more, and it just comes with time and with experience. You can take all the classes in the world that you want. Like, lots of people just take all these classes and think that they're just ready and they know everything about fire, and that's definitely not the case. My dad's been doing this for 20 plus years, and I mean, he's completely humble about it. He would never make anybody think that he knew more than them, and he knows a lot about fire. And I see that from the things that he tells me, and then I see it applied out there. And he's always trying to learn new things, always just completely open to learning more stuff about fire.
Do you think part of that is just plain old respect for the fire?
Yeah, probably. it's a big, scary thing, fire, but you have to respect it. People get hurt when they underestimate Mother Nature.
Jessica Hawkinson is a firefighter, originally out of Troy, Idaho, where she grew up and where her family still lives. She's now living in Boise, and she's planning to be out with her brothers and her father this summer, wherever the fires are raging. You're listening to Yin Radio, and our show today is called Man's World. Up next is our last installment of the day, and it comes from the world of politics. Idaho is so heavily Republican that only 7 of the 28 senators in the State House are Democrats, and the number of women to men is equally unbalanced. In the House, the ratio is a little better, 18 of 52. Incredibly, no, that number holds for the ratio of women to men and for Democrats to Republican. But it's not that all women are Democrats, it's just a coincidental convergence of the numbers. It is clear that getting elected to this body, however, will put any woman right in the center of a man's world. One woman, who also is a Democrat, got elected to the Senate last year, bringing the number of women up to 8 of 28 total. She's Nicole Lefevre, an educator who served 4 years in the House before her successful run for the Senate seat. Anna Maria Roque sat down to talk with Nicole recently, on January 5th this year, in the temporary Senate building. The Capitol building is under construction. And they talked about the world of politics in Idaho.
You know, there are as few women in the Senate here as there are Democrats, which means 7 women, 7 Democrats out of 35. So it's a really small number. And I know that there are so many perspectives not represented in here on committees, everything from education to health and welfare, prison issues, you know, budget writing. There aren't women's voices and women's experiences weighing in. And there are so many times I know that's absent, and I know it's really urgent that not be absent. And you know, I have never raised children, and I don't have children at home, and I know that the perspective of somebody who has had to take primary responsibility for young people and for, you know, the care and the whole thing that goes with raising kids is a perspective we absolutely need in here. And a lot of men in here were not raised in times where they played a large part in their children's upbringing and or in their children's education. I think, you know, it wouldn't be rare in here to find people who really haven't set foot in a classroom more than a couple times in their lives. and yet some of these people are making education policy. And to me, that's a problem. I think it's really important to have perspectives that represent the state and a legislature that looks like the state. And our legislature hardly has 54% women in it, so we need that.
Do you think we'll be seeing changes after Hillary Clinton and Palin?
You know, I've learned a lot about the way how political parties work, and it's very much about who gets asked to run sometimes. And I don't think people realize how important it is that sometimes you just have to say, you know, I think I can do this. And again, I say we need all different perspectives in here. And if you provide a perspective you know is missing, and you're willing to work hard, and you have great relationships with people in your community for whatever reason, because you're a soccer mom, or you're an organizer, or you're active in your church, or you do anything, work in politics, then you should think about it. And if you're passionate about issues, and political parties have a tendency to have structures that often just by default end up male dominated, and unless there are specific people who work hard and really have to persevere when, you know, things tend to move against them, then you really don't have the kind of leaders who tend to recruit other women and tend to respect and include them once they're in. So that's really important.
Talk to me a little bit about running for office, like campaigning, and you know, the bad things and good things about it.
When I first decided to run, I think there were people who were like, oh no, you know, a gay person, that would be really a disaster. And I think some of my Democratic colleagues were a little concerned that, you know, the Democratic Party would become forever known then as the party of gay people. And so I had a very spirited primary. I had a tough Democratic primary in May of 2004. I had Brian Cronin, who's one of my legislative colleagues now. It's fabulous to get to serve with him. But he and a former legislator from Canyon County, Steve Scanlon, both ran in the same race I did. And I declared fairly early, so they both jumped into the race after I did. And so we had a three-way primary, and there were times when people were saying things like, you know, she's a single issue candidate, which I'm like, which issue would that be? Is that healthcare or is it public transportation? You know, and or, you know, that I would win the primary and then lose the general. I mean, that kind of idea of, sure, she can do okay with Democrats, but she'll never get Republicans to vote for her. And, you know, I just think people after the primary were pretty surprised. I got 54% of the vote, or 53 or 52, in spite of the fact that it was a three-way primary. So I think people took me more seriously then. And I put together a pretty groundbreaking campaign team, and did really, I think, solid grassroots work. And for a couple of years, my campaigns were used as an example by people in the party, and or at least in the grassroots movement. And so that was nice. And I think, too, once people got to know me, they could tell that I really do work hard, and I have knowledge on quite a few issues from my life experience. So, you know, as a Democrat in Idaho, and I think, generally speaking, I'm not a great fan of political parties. If I had my way, we wouldn't have them. Yeah. I really... Yeah, I think proportional representation might be kind of nice. You have a little bit more diversity in what's represented. I think political parties have a tendency to polarize things more than they need to be. And so I would really love it if we just all were in here doing work on the issues, and that's the way it worked. Because, I mean, on any given day, you know, one of my colleagues who I may disagree with on one issue will be working together on another issue, you know, the next minute even, potentially, in floor debate. And, you know, that's the way it is. Very few things fall along party lines. And so I think parties make it challenging.
How did you get involved in politics?
I've always been a very issue-focused person. I've worked on human rights issues and healthcare issues and public transportation and all kinds of things for many, many years. Tax policy was one of the things I worked on a great deal right before I was elected. And just that interest in the issues and starting to see how many of them were impacted by legislation or needed legislation to see advancement. I started working with the legislature, and then started working on campaigns. And that was for everything from city council to legislative campaigns. I'd go and, you know, drop literature for Sue Rentz or Betsy Dunklin or our other, you know, legislators. I worked as staff on the No on One campaign in 1994, which was a statewide campaign that shocked the nation when it defeated an anti-gay ballot initiative here in Idaho, and was a really incredible experience because, you know, it's very rare that a progressive person in a very conservative state has a chance to feel what is possible, and that it is possible to prevail on an issue that at first is seen as a given that you'll lose it. And so that was a really, I think, important and wonderful way to enter politics. After that, I worked on another statewide campaign as staff, and then, you know, have helped tons of candidates over the years, and then on my own campaign. So,
what are some of the biggest issues, or your most passionate issues?
You know, over time, obviously, you know, I just think that in Idaho, it's still possible to be fired from your job simply because you are or are perceived to be gay, as something that has to end. And I think most of my colleagues agree that. You know, they are often surprised to learn that it is still legal to fire someone just solely on the basis of their sexual orientation or gender identity. And I think that there's room for that to change. For more than, I guess, 10 years now, I've been talking with legislators about these issues. And employment discrimination is one of the ones that has always seemed to have, you know, a pretty substantial amount of sympathy and understanding and respect. And I think with time we can do that here. Hopefully this year would be really nice. So we'll be presenting that this year. Public transportation, I mentioned that a whole bunch of times. You know, I live in a very urban district, probably the most urban district in the state. And I'm right here in downtown Boise, the capital where we're sitting is in my district. And, you know, I know that people all over the state are really struggling to make ends meet this year. And people with disabilities, seniors, have a really hard time getting around. We have very little funding for public transportation, none in some areas, and the state doesn't contribute at all. So we've been trying to get a local option sales tax where the local people would vote to approve a sales tax for the use, you know, with the budget and everything clear to them on the ballot of how it would be used for public transportation, like light rail or buses or trolleys or whatever combination would work best for that area. And so I've been working on that for many years, and we'll continue this year. I'm not on the Revenue and Taxation Committee because I love tax policy issues. It seems so boring to so many people, but it really is fascinating. I like numbers, and I know how important it is. I mean, it's a very, very strong reflection of our values, who we choose to tax and who we don't. We're always giving away tax incentives and tax breaks and, in my opinion, frequently not to the right people. Small businesses get very little in the state legislature. So, I've worked on growth issues in the sense of trying to make growth pay for itself a bit more in our state. We really, right now, have a lot of existing property taxpayers tend to pay for the cost of new developments, and really that's quite wrong. Our property taxes are rising because of that. I could go on and on. I work on an awful lot of issues. I have new committees this year, though, so I learn a lot.
Are most of your issues, did it have any, like, personal backing? Like, I mean, obviously the GLBT issues, but any other ones?
Oh, public transportation. You know, I walk as much as I can, but there are places I can't get. It's so critical, and for so many people who don't have a choice as well. Or it's, you know, we know all know, but gas is going to go back up, and it's going to be dreadful to drive again. So, personal backing. You know, I'm serving for the first time on the Health and Welfare Committee this year, and you know, in a very difficult economic time, you know, we are the committee that oversees many of those programs that people need when they lose their jobs and they need job training, or they can't afford food, or they need housing assistance or childcare assistance. And unfortunately, our governor has decided to go with across-the-board budget cuts. And when you do that, frankly, at a time when you're going to see an increasing number of people needing that help, you're going to be cutting back what you can offer. And in my mind, that is really somewhat unconscionable. And so I'll be really working hard to find where in the budget we can cut, to try and make sure that people stay afloat in this difficult time. Mm-hmm. So,
see a light at the end of the tunnel?
Oh, I think things might get a little better before they get... I'm a little worse before they get better, but I think they will get better. You know, there are going to be some tough things, and, you know, we've been pretty lopsided for a while. I think our economy has. I think personal debt and our debt as a nation, our debt as a state, and, well, our state government isn't in debt except in our Garvey bonding for giant freeways and roads. But our practice of trade, and we have a lot of different things that are causing our economy a great deal of hardship, and I think are ill thought out. So I have a bit of passion too for small farms and ranches.
You grew up in rural area.
I did. I grew up in central Idaho in Custer County between Stanley and Challis, and up and down spots on the Salmon River, and worked in the wilderness areas back there in the backcountry. And I really do worry about our loss of farmlands and our loss of our ability to produce food, and, you know, to see that part of our economy and that part of our society weakened is worrisome. I think we have some really great opportunities as well for local growers and producers to produce goods for local markets, and that kind of change in how we buy and how we eat is becoming more and more evident and kind of exciting. And there's a really good group of people here, a bunch of farmers and ranchers from all over the valley, including a bunch in Nampa and Caldwell and out of Canyon County, and across the southern part of the state as well, in Twin Falls and other areas, who are doing really innovative things and finding ways to make their businesses work and their farms work and make a profit. And that's a tough thing to do right now. I think our Department of Agriculture isn't as familiar with some of the potential out there as it might be, and I think it'll be exciting as they start to work together a little bit more. I look forward to seeing that happen. So, you know, when things get difficult and things break down a bit, if we aren't able to grow enough of our food here, you know, we really do put ourselves at risk, and I feel that's doubly true of energy policy and energy production. And to be more self-sufficient, I think, is really wise for our economy. It insulates us. We have incredible alternative energy potential here in Idaho. We have some of the best in the nation because we have a combination of wind, solar, geothermal, hydro, mm-hmm. all of it. And we put very little of it to use. Good stuff.
Do you want to go national? Your politics, you personally?
I think, you know, Congress and serving, you know, and getting to work on energy policy nationally and healthcare policy nationally would be a dream thing to get to do. I do. But, you know, if there's so much here to do, it's really hard, you know, just to give that up either. So I really enjoy it here. Than a church wedding.
Certainly. What's the best thing about being a politician?
You know, as a member of the minority, in many ways, shapes, and forms, but as a member of the minority, as a Democrat in a Republican legislature, I have passed legislation, and that is a wonderful feeling, mostly on mental health and substance abuse issues, mental health parity, pilot project, and a number of other pieces. But one of the things I guess I can maybe say that I do best is... I do help kill bad bills. And, you know, there are days it needs to be done. You know, those issues that squeak by out of a committee because they benefit one group and hurt another. There are a lot of times mm-hmm. that bills do that. And it is a struggle within our own body that it crosses party lines, nothing to do with parties, where half of us think it's really bad who this hurts, and others think, well, it's more important who it benefits. Mm-hmm. And that debate and the need to kill some of those bills, because usually they hurt small businesses or lower-income people or people who typically are disadvantaged in other ways or have less power. And killing those bills is an important thing. So I work with my Republican colleagues, and we get it done.
Where did you learn to debate?
I've always enjoyed debating. It's funny, I think in my high school I was fairly well known as somebody who liked a good debate, but, you know, I think it comes when you're passionate about an issue, when you know that real people's lives are at stake, and you can feel that and you can articulate that. That's important.
If you personally could have put one issue on the ballot this last November, what issue would you put on?
I don't know, this might surprise you, but probably our minimum wage. You know, and I say that because I think one of the greatest problems with our economy right now is wages. I think you have so many people trying to own homes and make ends meet and ending up in debt just over medical bills, over the cost of rental housing or mortgages, and over just childcare. And with two-thirds of our economy being consumer spending, you know that if you have too many people who fall below the wage at which they really can keep even and not fall into debt, then you really have a problem. You have a hollow place in your economy, and a place that inevitably will implode. And you just can't, people just can't stay, and an economy can't support that type of debt and that type of personal debt and that big hollow place. And a lot of people who are supporting families are having to work several jobs at once, and that's hard on the kids. Then you've got to pay for childcare for all those hours, and it's incredibly expensive. We don't even regulate childcare in the state of Idaho. It's done on occasion in some cities. And so, you know, you could be putting your kid in a place with no phone, or, you know, without really adequate supervision in some cases, or facilities, or educational content. They could be just parked in front of a television all day and no one would know. So it's not good.
Not good, and not good at all. So you live and breathe politics at all times.
It sometimes feels like it. It feels like it. I love the backcountry. One of my favorite places in the world to be is, you know, with a backpack on my back, far, far from everything. Mm-hmm. But I worked as a wilderness ranger for 7 years, built wilderness ranger and fire lookout for 7 years, and so lived very far from everything. No radio, no television, no newspaper. So it's a little still place in me that I kind of carry around with me. But my partner Carol probably would laugh at that question, because sometimes we do kind of live and breathe every day. We wake up in the morning and, you know, chat about what's on our handhelds while we lay in bed, or, you know, the news or whatever. And, you know, wherever we go, you know, people are always coming up and having wonderful ideas and things they want to chat about. And so it's a really neat thing. If we need to get away, we go hiking or go running in the foothills and stuff.
Yeah. For a minute.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You have to have some balance, and that's a really good thing about my partner Carol. She has a great sense of humor. So when things get their worst, she can always make me laugh.
<That's>
yeah. Yeah, and she is so smart too. If I'm coming up with something that I think maybe this might not be a good idea, I'm not sure, I will always ask Carol, because she will bluntly tell me whether that's a really dumb idea or not. She's saved me many times.
That's good.
So, yeah.
What's the most heated up argument you've seen on the floor?
Actually, Representative Clark had a stroke on the floor of the House last year.
Mm-hmm.
Over one of the bills that he was very passionate about, and I was debating on the other side of that particular bill. So that was a heated moment. It was really heated because we were really worried about him. You know, all of us have to, you know, get really fiery and you know, oppose each other for that half hour, or in that case 2 hours of debate, and then on the next issue again we might be debating right next to each other on the same issue. But that was a very heated one. Yeah, there were some stomping of feet and fists. And
Idaho State Senator Nicole Lefevre talking with Anna Maria Roque this month in Boise. Background music is El Vit by Sydney Poma. This installment was produced in part with support from the Pride Foundation Northwest. We've brought you 4 stories from women living and working in a man's world. So let's wrap up this Yin Radio show with a song from Californian Audra Hart. It's called Watch Me.
Maybe I can, and maybe I can't. Maybe I do or don't need a man. What if I will? What if I won't? Open your eyes, boy.
today's show was produced by Anna Maria Roque and Sandy Billings. If you want to hear past shows or podcast this show, you can do that at yinradio.org. And that's where you can sign up for our electronic newsletter to find out what's going on and what's coming up at Yin Radio. You can also find Yin Radio on MySpace and Facebook. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, by VP Foundation. And you can contact us at yinradio at V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. That's vpfound.org. I'm your producer and host, Sandy Billings, and I am glad you joined me. Until next week.
I'm out for blood. Rarely have I doubted you. Never have I strayed away. Always have told you the truth. Now you wanna fade away. What? I'm out for...